Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, product owners all over this great big world, including the people listening in Minsk, Belarus. Welcome back to Deliver It. This is your Agile Product Owners Podcast. My name is Corey O'Brien, and I am getting back into reading. I've been making a concerted effort over the last 2-3 weeks to spend more time sitting down with a book, Kindle book, and spending more time reading. And it's been pretty good because I've got a lot of good recommendations on books from people from various places, and I haven't made the time to do it. It's something I always enjoy doing. So I've made a concerted effort to do it more. And one of those books is one of the conversations, one of the things I want to recommend today. And then another one is something I'm sure is going to change some of the ways I'm doing things in the future because I've already 40% through it and it's really, really good so far. So the one that I finished that I really liked was Agile Conversations from Douglas Squirrel and Jeffrey Frederick. Those are the two gentlemen who do the Troubleshooting Agile podcast, which is a great podcast, a very good 15-minute, usually bite-size, real targeted problem in most Agile teams or people who are trying to do Agile. So I really like that podcast, and they've been talking about their book that they've coming out, Agile Conversations, and I really, really recommend the book. It's got some really good insights and some really good skills, some that I've already started applying and have already started mentoring and coaching others on with some good results. They have a very interesting opening statement. And they say, after years of study and many missteps, we have come to understand that the key to success is not only adapting practices, but having the difficult conversations that foster the right environment for those practices to work. So again, it's about culture, it's about setting up that culture, and it's about making sure that the practices that you're doing with agility are going to be able to be successful and sustainable once you start doing that. So I really resonate with me and some of the problems I've seen in organizations where you get started, you have some success, but you can't really sustain it. Two items that they really talk a lot about that are critical to this are transparency and curiosity. Actually having genuine questions and real questions that you want to know. They define it as something you want to know. The answer might surprise you. So if you're asking a question you already know the answer to, that's not a genuine question. And it might be something that you're willing to change your behavior as a result of the answer. So you ask a question, you get an answer. Maybe that changes what you were thinking about doing, what you're going to do next, or how you're going to approach something based on that question. So that curiosity, those genuine questions, that's where I've been focused a lot. I think I mentioned that with David Marquez's book, as well as transparency. And that's one of the things they talk a lot about. And they go into different conversations, the different conversations that you have during transformations or adult journeys or anything else, and the priority of those conversations. They actually do rank these in terms of you have to establish the trust conversation first. You have to be able to get through that trust conversation before you get to the next conversation, which is the fear conversation. After you do the fear conversation, you get to the why conversation, the commitment conversation, and then the accountability conversation. In those orders, if you try to go right to the commitment conversation without having the fear conversation, you're going to miss something. It's not going to be as effective. And they do a really interesting way of diagramming conversations, something I hadn't seen before, and something I think would be hard to do real time. But as I record meetings or as I think about meetings and think about things that are said, it's a really interesting way to go back and try to diagram the conversation and look at that. And that's one of the things they talk about is their four R's for that is record, reflect, revise, and role play. The role play I'm not as big on, but the record, reflect, and revise, I really like that combination of let's see what I'm saying, let's see what you're saying, let's see what we're thinking, let's see what's transparent, and let's see what questions are there. So a really good book. Highly recommend Agile Conversations from Squirrel and Jeffrey. The next thing I read was from Josh Karieski, who has an article called Why Are Component Teams Still So Popular? Something that I've had several conversations lately about is component teams and why they're either still here, how we can get to cross-functional teams, why those cross-functional teams are so resisted, feature teams are so resisted in organizations by people or what have you. So a really good explanation, really good conversation, a really good exploration of why Josh thinks this is. And he goes through and identifies three different types of component teams, which I think is a good distinction here. He has shared component teams, unshared component teams and mixed teams. The shared component teams are the ones that I've seen and also used and set up as a product owner, where we have an API or we have an export or something that other products or other teams are going to consume. So we're providing that as a service, and that's a big thing. That's a component, but it's a component of a larger system that most people can use. That is okay. That's not the worst thing, especially when you have a big enterprise system or something like that. It's the unshared where you're doing the same thing multiple times with multiple teams, and they're not going back and forth with information. That's where you get really into trouble, is with those unshared. One of the statements he makes, and I agree with, is unshared component teams are a root cause of mediocre performance. So if your organization is struggling with Agile, if your organization is struggling with delivery, part of the reason is probably that you don't have feature teams. You have component teams, and those component teams are not interacting with each other in an Agile way. Something Klaus Leopold talks about a lot with flight levels and rethinking Agile is, are those teams interacting in an Agile way? And if they aren't, what can you do about that? Again, my default is, let's set up feature teams and let's go from there. He has several reasons why people might be still stuck on component teams. The three that I liked, one is risk averse, that they don't want to, they know what works now, whether it works well or not. They really don't want to change it unless there's overwhelming evidence that what we're going to change to is going to work. So there's a risk that it might not work. And because of that, they don't want to do anything. So unless it's 100% guaranteed to work and work quickly, which it never is, there's always things that have to be done, they don't want to do it. So risk aversion is one reason. Too entrenched. So that manager or that director may have been there for 20 years, and that team may be doing the same thing. They may be just the UI team, and they've been doing that for 15 years, and they don't want to change, and nobody wants to change them. So everything is just kind of stuck. So everything's there. And that specialization, so you may have an architect, you may have a database person, you may have a UX person that, again, that's their specialization, that's their identity, that's what they went to college for, that's what they've spent 15 years in the industry doing. And to now ask them to be part of a cross-functional team, they're going to lose something. Something I think we talked about with David Frank is they lose that identity, and that's very powerful. And so they like to be specialized. So that's some of the reasons. Again, really good article from Josh, and I hope you check it out.
No doubt that this magnificent vessel will give excellent value for the dollars she'll be earning.
All right, as a reminder, this is the last episode of Season 6, so we do a big grab bag of questions, answer as many questions as I can, see what's out there, and then we will end the season, be back after a break of 4 months, and we'll be back for Season 7. So if you have a question, you're always free, or always welcome, to send it in. So that it can be asked. So if you have a question, you can always send it in. For any feedback or questions about product ownership, you can contact the show on Twitter at DeliverCast or email us at DeliverCast@gmail.com. Please share the show around with friends or coworkers, subscribe, and help us reach more folks. And the first question we're going to answer today is from Dylan, who has a question about varied hours and capacity planning for next sprint. So some of these questions are pretty long. I tried to edit them down. We'll see how this goes. So Dylan says, I manage a charity and we've had some good success using Scrum to create incrementally better pieces of work, such as new processes and annual reports. Congrats, Dylan. Provided we take part in the ceremonies together, can team members work both at different times in the week and on their own? The nature of our work means that when one person is free, another is usually not. So very difficult to get anyone together other than for the stand-ups, etc. I'm going to take each section of his questions as we go. So can team members work on their own and with others? Yes. Ideally, you would like to swarm more. You'd like to have people work together collaboratively, especially in a Scrum environment or especially in a mob type environment where you're doing things together, you're learning from each other. If you can't do that, then yeah, they can, they can work on their own. They can have their own tickets, but that's kind of an anti-pattern. So as much as you can avoid doing that, I would. But it's not the end of the world, especially if they're communicating and syncing together frequently and everybody knows kind of what they need to do and everybody can help if they need to or ask for help if they need to. Second part, does each team member need to do the same number of hours per week on the sprint? We have a mix of part and full-time staff, and they also have varied workloads, which means they can have some time this week and not much next. No, I mean, that's kind of your capacity planning when you're doing your sprint planning. Usually, if you get real picky about it, you can go to capacity. So I may have, typically you figure, 6 hours a day for a two-week sprint? So multiply that times 10, 60 hours, that's how much time you're going to have because you have meetings and other things that get done. Sometimes you cut that back to 5 hours a day, and that's your capacity per day. And sometimes if you've got training, if you know you're going to be off for 2 days, or if you're going to be in a training for a day or so, I'd cut that back by that number of hours. So I may not have, if I normally would have 60 hours or so on a sprint, maybe I don't have 60 hours this week. Maybe I have 50, or maybe I have 30, and that's okay. So I don't think that's a big deal. Again, if it becomes an issue, especially with part-time staff, I would want to know kind of where they can plug in and what they can help with. But no, I don't see that being a very big deal. And it's not a problem if they have different hours. Third part, so far we've been using points for velocity, but I've been using planned people hours, total number of staff hours we can dedicate the next sprint, based on what we know about workload, leave, etc. And sprint planning is an indication of what capacity we'll have for the next sprint. Yes, that's kind of what I just talked about. Some team members have shown frustration at having to time box these hours. If it turns out they have more hours available during the sprint than we originally forecast, is there any reason why they can't work more hours? Within healthy limits, of course. No, absolutely not. If you had training that was going to be there, or your vacation got canceled and your training didn't happen, no reason you can't go back and say, hey, look, I've got more time available. What can I help with? Or, I had planned for 50 hours. Those tasks that I got done with on day three, I can pick up some more tasks. Perfectly fine. Again, it's rough planning. It's not exact planning. If you didn't get your planning right, there's no penalty for that, or there shouldn't be a penalty for getting your planning close, but not exact. Again, this is not a Gantt chart that we're trying to fill in here. I'm allergic to Gantt charts. They make me itch, and I break out in hives. So no Gantt charts. So I hope that helps. Dylan? Then I got a question from Kib, who asks, is a psychology degree considered for PO positions? Ooh. He says, I have a friend who has a degree in psychology. He has a very good background both in work and academically speaking. Since I work in tech as a developer, I suggested him to start searching for a PO role to see what matches skills. I thought there was a good match, at least in regards to soft skills and understanding where our product should go, as his psychology background would help in both of these things. I don't want him spending money on certifications or things like that, not having opportunities afterwards. It kind of depends on what he's interested in. I think psychology is a great way to get into user empathy and team empathy and being able to do that. I think it's a great thing. One of the Marine, when I've talked about her and talked with her as a coach and as a Scrum Master, she has a psychology degree. So she was very much better at dealing with people issues or team issues than most other people because she has that background. She has that skill that I think is very important. So as a product owner, I think it's incredibly powerful to be able to understand human behavior, both from, like I said, your teams, your stakeholders, and your customers. It's one of the things we've talked about with empathy, being able to empathize with your user. Why would somebody want to do this? Your friend may have trouble with the technical aspects of it, or some understanding aspects of it over the business side or something like that. If they do, there's ways to learn that, especially product things or product management type skills or product owner type skills. That's teachable and that's learnable. It just depends on what they want, really. So I think it's a good idea. My minor interest in behavioral economics is kind of that same type of thing, is how do people make decisions and what do they do? So I would equate it somewhere with that, although mine was a hobby. Got a question from Emo about splitting into two Scrum teams. Says, currently we have 6 developers, a PO, and a Scrum Master, who's also a QA. Our UI and UX designer is a shared resource with other departments and is not part of the Scrum team per se. So kind of floating there, I guess. Says, we have a B2C app and are currently building a completely new B2B product. These two products have technical dependencies, though. I am currently working as a PO for both products, and it is slowly getting impossible to focus on two different things. So we decided to hire a few more developers and a PO to split into two teams. Question is, should we separate our backlog, which currently consists of B2B and B2C tickets, into two separate backlogs and have two POs managing their own backlogs? If yes, how do we synchronize the teams and all the other ceremonies? Do we have one product backlog managed by two POs? Okay. So if they're different products, my decision would kind of rest on how different are the products. They said they had some technical dependencies. Is that kind of like they both use the same login? They both use the same reporting engine, something like that. Maybe some APIs that they both use, or maybe one passes information to the other. That's possible. If they're different products and different markets for those products, I would probably say it would make sense to split them into two different things. You don't have to, of course. You can have one backlog and then have a different view into those backlogs depending on which product you're looking at. But for this, it seems like it is more cut and dry that there's a B2C product and a B2B product. And those two things probably share some similarities. Actually, what you may need to do is have a third team out of there that focuses on the core shared components. Just like we talk with the component teams, there may be something there that both of those teams need. And if the teams need to be able to work back and forth on different areas of that they share between those two products, that may be a good thing to do, is have that third team that's focused on infrastructure and common elements while the two feature teams work on delivering B2B features and B2C features. So hope that helps with you, Emo. Rain has a question about a major UI overhaul on an Agile team. Says, I've been working on a team that has been running a mobile live service product for 5 years. We're approaching a point in which our UI feels dated and needs to be updated. While we could deliver bits of the UI over multiple sprints, we wouldn't want to release a disjointed experience to our users. How have you overcome this challenge? How have you prevented large design up front? Okay. Definitely something that I've done before, and definitely something that people struggle with. It's that there gotta be, if we're changing the site, it's gotta be 100%. We can't change four pages and not the other 50, even though that's what you should do. So what I have done before in that situation is we would go through the process. We'd have our sprints, or we'd have our releases of the new pages, the new functionality, the new whatever we're building. We would release that into production, and we would either feature flag it or hide it behind something. So it's out and it's running, and a couple people could access it. Like I could access it, some of our stakeholders, some of our customer service reps, they could access this page, try them out in production with production data, but the customers couldn't see it. We've also had situations where we turned it on for customers who opted in to those experiences. You see it often when applications, I know Jira does this, and I know some of the other products do this. Miro has done this, something where they say, hey, there's a new version of Jira coming. Would you like to check it out now? And it gives people a kind of way to opt into that. And then you can get some feedback on the things you've already built, the things you just built before you go further down that road, maybe in the wrong direction, or validate some of the things you've already built. So I would still, as much as you can, build during the sprint, release to production, get it out there, get somebody using it, and maybe, again, open it up to a few select users, or do some A-B testing with that too, is kind of get people to say, hey, we've tried different ways to go about the screen. And then when all the sprints are done and you've gotten enough out there where the stakeholders, the customers, the marketing team, whatever, says, okay, we've got the new version, let's push it all live. You don't have a big deploy. What you've got is a big turn on. People, you flip the switch, and then everybody sees the new thing. But it's been live, and it's been working for weeks, sometimes months, before that happened. That's how I would do that. And I would do that also with anything that's UI, UX, back-end, database, any of those elements. If you're replacing parts of it, I would do it a little bit at a time, try to integrate where you can, test as you go, and see what works. Hopefully that helps, Rain. I had a question from Olina, who says, hi, I would like to pick your brain. I have a whole new team of approximately 15 persons, and we're now responsible for dev and maintenance of several sites. Would you suggest splitting the team in two and distribute the projects among the two teams? And also, what best practice here regarding Jira, one board per project, or merge to one board. We have one PO for all projects. Okay. 15 people is large for a team. So gut says, yeah, you'll probably want to split that up. Splitting it up into a team for dev and a team for maintenance, that's one of those silos. Maybe you need that. Like if there's a lot of maintenance that needs to go on, if there's a lot of customer service work or something like that, that justifies it, maybe. I'd fall into the camp. I'd rather have the team that are building the thing be the team that supports it as well. And that goes across everything. So maybe I would have two teams that do both dev and maintenance in specific areas of the product or specific features, capabilities, whatever on that. And if it's the same product, I would definitely have the same backlog, the same Jira, the same instance and everything else. Again, you can split up how the teams view that. You can see each team's board individually, or you can see one holistic view of the project, dare I use that word, product really, and what's going on. So sounds like yes, Alina, but it really depends on how much maintenance and how much customer service needs to be done versus how much new development and support needs to be done is kind of where I would draw the line, is how those two teams are organized. Got a question from Bernard, who says, I frequently see developers and even product managers using Agile or Kanban methodologies without distinguishing between internal business value, example, tasks being done, and external business value, that is, user stories completed. I won't take issue with that just yet. This seems like a very important distinction to me, but I observe that usual Scrum descriptions, for instance, do not address that topic right away. Have you seen a more formal explanation or wording for those than my internal, external, or inside, outside ones? Yeah, that's something I struggle with when you're not really looking at the external business value, user stories completed or not business value delivered. Just to clear that up, business value delivered is the capabilities that change your behavior of your users or change the outcome, what the users are able to do. That's your business value delivered. It doesn't matter how many stories that took, whether those stories were successful or not. It's about the outcomes that you're trying to generate. And those are really the only things that matter. I had my head in my hands the other day because I heard somebody say that we did what the business asked for. We delivered the FRD or the parts of the FRD, functional requirements document, and I kind of just shook my head. Customers don't care about that. Customers don't pay for FRDs. They don't pay for those types of things. They pay when they have something that they value and something that increases their enjoyment, increases their life, increases their business, however they do that. So I would focus mostly on external business value, what you've got there, Bernard. I would focus very little on internal business value. Again, depends on how you're set up. I think that would work for 80% of your cases and most of people's cases. I think 80% that would work. There are going to be some instances, yes, where you have teams that are delivering to other teams. And those teams frequently refer to their people who are asking, the stakeholders, as the internal business value. And that's fine, but I don't think that's going far enough. I think once you identify that internal business value, you need to take the next step and then go to external business value. Okay, so we've delivered feature X for this internal team. What are they going to do with it? And how can we help them and help their customers get better? That's where value stream mapping and everything else comes in that we've talked about a lot. So, that's kind of my take on it. I don't like that internal business value. It really should be on external business value. All right, and then the last question that I've got is from Neil. I heard on a podcast a few months ago a name for the phenomenon of not knowing what you want until you see something which isn't quite what you want. Very true. It's definitely something that it's one of the reasons we want to iterate on things, because people don't really know what they want until they see it. He says, it's hard for stakeholders to express what they need when given a blank whiteboard, but show them the first iteration of your product and they can much more easily express what they really needed all along. Absolutely true. Does anyone know the formal name of this effect? Neil, the best I could do was come up with two tests. So it's not an effect name, and it's not one of these cognitive biases things that I could find, even that list of 80-some that we did in the episode on cognitive biases. There's two kind of tests for that that I found references to. One of them is the duck test. If it looks like a duck, quacks like a duck, walks like a duck, it's probably a duck. That one I don't think I'm relevant. I like that one. I like the idea of the duck test. The one I think is more closely applicable to what you're talking about is the elephant test, something that's hard to describe, but it's instantly recognizable when you see it. You've seen the cartoon, hopefully, of the 7 or 8 scientists. They're blindfolded and each touching a different part of the elephant, and they're all trying to describe what they see, and they all describe something different. One guy is describing the ear, one guy's describing the trunk, another guy describing the foot, the tail, the side of the elephant. They're only looking at their part, but if they would only take off their blindfolds and step back, they could see that what they're actually looking at or trying to describe is a part of an elephant. So I would say that's probably the closest definition is the elephant test to the not knowing what you want till you see it. But I agree, that's the right way to do things. Most of the things that we're trying to do, especially as product folks, is get something out there, get some feedback on it, iterate on it, keep going, and learn what they really want or what they really need as we go. Because very likely, they don't know yet. They have an idea. They have some type of problem they want to solve. Again, the most important thing, what problem do they have? And then see if what we did helps them on that, or if they understand what we built. And if not, then we need to iterate. Again, I think I've defined iterations as you do something 3 times. So you've put something out into a customer, they've tried it out, they've used it, you've tried that 3 different times, 3 different ways, and you've gotten a little bit better every time. But the important thing is you get it out there first, you get some feedback on it, and then you iterated on it. And you did that quickly. I think it's the other thing that people fail a lot at is they don't iterate quickly. They spend 6 months on release 1 and then 6 months on release 2. So that second iteration would be 6 months later. And I don't think that's really an iteration. I think that's more of another release and probably not doing a lot of things you should be doing anyway. So I like that question, Neil. Thank you very much for that. All right. And that will do it for this episode, nay, this season of Deliver It. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in this really weird year that we've been having. I think when I started this season was right at the beginning of March. So quarantines and all the things had just hit. I know folks have not had the commutes that they usually have. And so folks have been at home more, listening when they can. So thank you all for continuing to listen. It really does mean a lot. And again, if you have suggestions for either guests that I should talk to about product ownership, product, or anything like that, or if you have recommendations on books or anything like that, or if you yourself want to share your product owner story, you're more than welcome to send me a note, and we'll see when we can get you in next season. So we will be on a break for 4 months, come back season 7 in March of 2021. How about that? And don't forget that if you would like any one-to-one coaching, product consulting, or organizational agility help, I do offer that over at seektaiju.com. Just head over there, send me a note, and we'll see what we can get done for you. All opinions expressed here are mine, and you can find more of them at IsCoreyBryan on Twitter. That is episode 118, Delivered. Go out and own the outcome.
Podcast Network. For more shows and information, visit agilepodcastnetwork.com.